From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is in the building, but busy on some other damn thing. I'm Bob Garfield.
The committees on the Judiciary and Commerce will come to order. We welcome everyone to today's hearing on Facebook's social media privacy and the use and abuse of data.
This week, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg finally appeared before not one but two congressional committees to answer for privacy invasion, fake news, murderous hate speech, ISIS propaganda, censorship, and tell me again, what's a poke? And as a supercut assembled by the Open Market Institute demonstrates, Zuckerberg was exactly as forthcoming as expected.
I'm not specifically aware. I mean, I'm not sure. No, I do not. Not sure what that means. I'm not sure. I do not have that information. Congresswoman, I'm not familiar. I'm not actually sure what that is referring to. I'm not sure either. Senator, I'm not sure if we need a law, but I think that this is certainly a thing that
Yet the ultimate truth did come out in the answer to a phenomenally naive question from 84-year-old Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah.
How do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
Yes, Senator, they run ads and target them with the biggest trove of user data amassed in human history, and therefore are very good at that, and therefore, along with Google, have utter domination of the online ad industry, which is half of the global ad economy and growing. Though there are tens of thousands of publishers, Google and Facebook suck up 60% of every dollar spent online and almost 100% of every dollar of ad market growth. Orrin Hatch's Republican colleague Lindsey Graham was close to understanding the implications.
If I buy a Ford and it doesn't work well and I don't like it, I can buy a Chevy. If I'm upset with Facebook, what's the equivalent product that I can go sign up for?
Well, there's the second category that I was going to talk about.
I'm not talking about categories. I'm talking about is there real competition you face? Because car companies face a lot of competition.
But, Senator, the customer we're discussing isn't the social media user. It is the advertiser who also has no comparable Chevy or Toyota to shop for. If a brand wants to reach 2 billion users or just a micro-targeted subset, there is no place to go but the duopoly. And so dominant are they that other publishers are forced to use Facebook and Google to distribute their content.
I mean, the problem is the business model.
Matt Stoller, a fellow at the Open Markets Institute and expert on antitrust issues, says Zuckerberg was actually content to talk about his company's efforts, say, to suppress hate speech.
He didn't want to talk about the core problem with Facebook, which is Facebook. So everything that people are seeing and they don't like, the privacy violations, the censorship, the incentives to foment ethnic hatred, both domestically and then even worse with the genocide in Myanmar, the electoral interference, the concentration of power in the advertising market, all of that is a result of the basic business model of Facebook.
And this brings Standard Oil of Ohio to mind. It brings AT&T to mind. It brings government breakups to mind.
I don't think there's anything at this point Mark Zuckerberg can do, whether he will try. I mean, the business model is flawed. You can't marry an essential communication service with this level of intrusive targeting and advertising. It's like if the phone company listened in on every conversation that you had and manipulated those conversations and also, you know, used what it heard to advertise to you. That business model has too many inherent conflicts of interest. So I do think you're going to need to see the business restructured. I think it does need to be split up.
Mark Zuckerberg can take off his big boy necktie and go back to his T-shirt. But as he surely understands, the real news here isn't about fake news. The real news is Facebook's existential challenge of staying in one piece. Coming up, the corrupting influence of money in politics in the old days and in contemporary Montana. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As Facebook's travails with fake news and Russian-paid political advertising make obvious, ceding basic democratic functions to digital juggernauts can subvert the political process. But you don't need data mining to muck with democracy. Facebook is only 14 years old. For the past more than a century, rich special interests have been corrupting American politics the old-fashioned analog way, with cash money. Especially since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling that ended restrictions on spending by corporations, labor unions, and so on political campaigns. Since that money is now unlimited, it has soared, and with it, the amount of money entirely out of public view, which the court declined to address. They call it dark money, the scourge of transparent politics. But what does it actually look like? That's what a new documentary called Dark Money seeks to find out, and it does so by zeroing in on a struggle that has taken place over the last few years in the state of Montana.
I don't know how to fight him. I don't know how to argue with him. I can't debate him. I can't interview him. I can't pick up the phone and say, hey, what's your interest in candidate X? Because I don't know who they are. We'll never know.
When director Kimberly Reed wanted to root out corruption in the campaign finance system, she went straight to her native Montana.
In grade school, every kid in Montana learns about the Copper Kings, about this battle between three influential guys in Butte, Montana, who are all trying to control the copper mines. The one who kind of won that out was William A. Clark. He also had an interest in politics and decided that he was going to get there by openly bribing all of the legislators in Montana. This was at a time when state legislators elected senators. So he just bought them off. He put ads in his own papers, which he owned, so that he could own the legislators who would vote for him to go to Washington, D.C. That actually led to the 17th Amendment, which declared that senators would be directly elected by the people who live in a state instead of the legislators. Knowing this history, knowing these battles between the Copper Kings, you kind of develop some healthy skepticism about the role in outside money in politics.
Now, Montana had healthy skepticism and some of the toughest campaign finance and oldest campaign finance laws in the country.
It all goes back to the Corrupt Practices Act of 1912, which essentially stated that, look, we have seen the corrupting effects that corporate control of our politics have, and we will therefore ban corporate contributions to political campaigns. That stood for about 100 years until Citizens United rolled around. So at the time, Attorney General Steve Bullock led the charge to defend Montana's 100-year-old law.
What we have in this record is an act that was passed by the people to address corporate corruption. And it's more than just the history, it's also the present.
All Bullock was saying was that, look, in Montana, we've seen this story before. We know what happens when big money comes in from out of state and gets involved in our politics. That's why we created the Corrupt Practices Act of 1912, and we think that that should hold sway in Montana. That did not hold sway.
22 states and the District of Columbia backed Montana's effort, but in a short half-page decision today, the court's five most conservative justices said the state law violated the free speech rights of corporations.
This is actually where I thought the film was going to start. I thought that We're going to have a quick 6-month film about the state of Montana goes to Washington, overturning Citizens United. That is not what happened. Instead of 6 months, it took me about 6 years.
But in that 6 years, something extraordinary did happen. You were working with an investigative reporter named John Adams, formerly of the Great Falls Tribune, who was working similar turf. And between you, you found a narrative that showed the very particulars about how all of this dark money works.
As we were following the influence of dark money in Montana, the name that kept popping up again and again and again was Western Tradition Partnership, which then actually changed its name to become American Tradition Partnership. It was clear that they were supporting a lot of Republican candidates in the 2010 primary, and one of those candidates was Art Wittig, who ended up becoming the Senate Majority Leader. After we dug a little bit at who was really behind American Tradition Partnership, it turns out that they were a front group for the National Right to Work Committee, an anti-union group that's run out of Virginia.
Now, you found this out through the most unlikely means. You got some leaked documents, or I don't know if even leaked is the right word, but it started in a car burglary out of state.
A bunch of documents regarding the 2008 and 2010 campaigns were found in a stolen car. The documents somehow left that stolen car and somehow ended up in Denver, Colorado, and something that everybody refers to as
a meth house that was being raided by the police, and someone who was there was heading out the window and grabbed file boxes with these documents.
And then apparently someone turned those documents over to a state senator in Colorado,
who mails them to the Commissioner of Political Practices in Montana.
This is a kind of a deus ex machina development. But nonetheless, these documents were smoking guns of the direct kind of string pulling of Western Tradition Partnership and American Tradition Partnership, and included a play-by-play for how the local candidates should run their campaigns and provided the materials to do that, which still, even in a Citizens United universe, is illegal.
The one thing that you still can't do is coordinate. But what was going on in these documents that we found was how these third-party groups were going to run the campaign for the candidates.
Advice on how to run your campaign, how to talk to the press, professionally written website, campaign slicks, life letter, gun letter, right to work letter, just a carpet bombing in the last few weeks before the election.
There's a line from one of their PowerPoint presentations, something to the effect that you can just go home, put your feet up, and watch the election results roll in.
Now, these documents emerged in the hands of a dinky little Montana state agency, under-resourced, understaffed, whose job it is to monitor campaign finance in the state. And they were not idle. They actually used it as the basis of a case against the legislator, Art Wittig.
That's correct. Thanks to the recent appointment of a commissioner of political practices who took his job really seriously, Jonathan Modell tried to get to the bottom of this.
And Art Wittig's testimony, which we see in the film, was, moi? Coordination? No, no, no. I scarcely knew these people existed.
I don't remember ever seeing this.
I'm looking at the documents that have been provided, and whether you meant to or not, it looks like you filled out A through D, correct?
I don't know. I don't think.
All right, that's fine if you don't know.
But the evidence was overwhelming.
That's right. And 10 out of 12 members of the jury found that Mr. Wittig had violated campaign finance law in Montana.
State lawmaker Art Wittig of Bozeman faced the judge today to hear his penalty for accepting illegal corporate campaign contributions.
Yet while the judge did not remove Representative Wittig from office, somebody else already has, the voters of his district.
He lost the Republican primary 10 days ago, and his term expires this December.
There's this dramatic scene in the movie where there is a supposed town hall being sponsored by the Koch brothers-funded Americans for Prosperity that nominally was to give information on the coming doom of Medicaid expansion, but was really kind of a politicking against the incumbent Republican legislator. So it's a room full of Republicans, and suddenly they realize that this game is rigged.
Hey, wait a second. What's going on here? What's going on here?
This isn't a public forum, ladies and gentlemen. Darling, I tell you some BS and you're going to have no chance to talk. If Jeff Wilburn walks, I walk. Bye.
So these are Republicans who came to a Republican meeting and shouted down the dark money guy. Many of them walked out of the town hall.
Money in politics it's not a left or right issue. And I think that's reflective of what's going on in the rest of the nation. Montana is just a microcosm when it comes to this. But I really think that campaign finance is going to move in the same way that marriage equality moved at a local grassroots level, that it's going to start with this city council over here and that city council over here and then a school board and then some more school boards and then a state is going to come behind it like Montana did, like California did. And pretty soon we're going to have a tipping point.
I don't want to puncture your hope balloon here, but the Koch brothers, for example, have poured most of their vast treasure spent on politics in the United States in state legislatures to pack them with conservative Republicans to sustain the very system that you would like to see dismantled. So that's a tough row to hoe, is it not?
It's a tough row to hoe. And the really scary thing is what you're seeing is dark money operating not only in candidate elections, not only on these 2 to 4 year cycles when people are running for office. What you've seen is the influence of dark money to affect policy once officials are elected. But this scene that we love in the film of everyday citizens standing up and walking out on a Koch brothers funded AFP town hall, I don't think that other states are too far away from paying that same sort of attention. Montana shows that there is a lot of hope because if you pay attention to these issues, if you vote on them, if you hold your elected officials accountable, that you can actually turn the tide. And you can turn the tide in a state that Mr. Trump won by 20 points.
Kim, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Kimberly Reed is the director of the forthcoming documentary, Dark Money, which will reach theaters in July and then be viewed in the fall on PBS's POV. The Citizens United decision, followed a few years ago by the Hobby Lobby decision, giving business owners the right to flout federal law based on their religious beliefs, outraged many Americans. The rulings seem to unreasonably expand corporate rights. If you are among the outraged, though, you haven't been paying attention to the past 300 or 400 years of court cases and American history. Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA, is the author of We the Corporations, How American Business Won Their Civil Rights. He says that the principle of corporate rights has been litigated forever and predates our very founding. We think, for instance, that our national origin story is all about pilgrims escaping tyranny and religious persecution.
Pilgrims are sort of the perfect embodiment of American values and how we like to see them. But the first permanent English colony was in Jamestown, and it was a corporate affair run by the Virginia Company of London, and it was designed to make money, not to exercise religious liberty.
All right. The Republic was born, I've heard rumored, in 1776. Within 33 years, the Supreme Court was already considering which inalienable rights applied not just to individual citizens, but associations of individual citizens. In other words, corporations. Please tell me.
While the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations was decided in 1809, to put that in some perspective, the first Supreme Court cases on the rights of African Americans and the rights of women weren't decided until 1857 and 1873, respectively. So a half century earlier, corporations were in the Supreme Court seeking the protections of the Constitution. Bank of the United States versus DeVoe, it really set the foundation for 200 years of Supreme Court cases expanding rights to corporations. The case involved the Bank of the United States, the most powerful corporation in America at the time, and it claimed a constitutional right to sue in federal court, even though the Constitution's text only provides that right to citizens.
Now, that case gets to something important that comes up even today. We often think of Citizens United and Hobby Lobby as being about corporate personhood.
While many people blame corporate personhood for Citizens United, in fact, corporate personhood is a very well-established legal principle going back hundreds of years in business law, and it basically says that a corporation is its own independent entity in the eyes of the law and is wholly separate and distinct in its legal rights and duties from the people who form it or the members of the corporation. In cases expanding the rights of corporations, however, the Supreme Court's generally ignored that principle and said that corporations have the same rights as their members. And so the courts generally treated the corporation not as its own individual person, but as an association of people. And if corporations have the same rights as their members, well, it's no surprise that corporations have nearly all the same rights as people.
Even if you think that Citizens United was uniquely, let's say, tortured in its conclusions, that is nothing compared to the abuse of the 14th Amendment, the one that gave rights to freed slaves. How in the world did that get into the legal conversation about corporations?
Well, in a remarkable series of test cases brought in the 1880s, the Southern Pacific Railroad Company, one of the most influential corporations in the West, brought a series of what its lawyers called test cases, more than 60 in all, seeking rights under the 14th Amendment for business corporations. And the Southern Pacific had an illustrious lawyer by the name of Roscoe Conkling. And Conkling went to the Supreme Court and argued that the 14th Amendment was written specifically to protect business corporations too. And Conkling would really know. He was the last surviving member of the drafting committee of the 14th Amendment. Historians have gone back and looked through Roscoe Conkling's argument and determined that he lied to the Supreme Court. One historian called it, quote, a deliberate brazen forgery to win new rights for corporations.
American history is filled with wars that were built on lies. Was Conkling's argument the Gulf of Tonkin of corporate rights?
In many ways, it was. Conkling's argument marked a shift where the 14th Amendment became used primarily by businesses to strike down regulation. And in the years to follow, the Supreme Court would go into one of its most business-friendly periods, known as the Lochner era among historians, between 1890 and 1937, where the Supreme Court broadly read the Constitution to protect businesses from all sorts of regulations, striking down maximum hour laws, minimum wage laws, zoning laws, federal child labor laws. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court refused to read the 14th Amendment expansively to protect the rights of African Americans, the intended beneficiaries of that provision. And in the years to follow, the Supreme Court would hear about 28 cases on the 14th Amendment rights of African Americans and 312 cases on the 14th Amendment rights of business corporations.
We in the media, I think it's fair to generalize, share a deep suspicion for the assigning of individual rights to entities whose ultimate legal responsibility isn't to the society at large, but to shareholders or members. But corporate rights have saved our bacon.
Some of the most important corporate rights cases over the course of American history involved expanding free speech rights to newspaper corporations. A prominent illustration came out of the effort of Louisiana newspaper companies who fought back against Huey Long, the iron-fisted demagogue and governor of Louisiana. And Long accused the newspapers of publishing fake news and stuck them with a tax on their advertising revenue. The newspapers challenged that tax in court as a violation of the freedom of the press. And in one of the earliest and most important freedom of the press cases by the Supreme Court, The Supreme Court sided with the newspapers. And to this day, the freedom of the press receives its most vibrant protection in cases brought by business corporations like the New York Times or the Washington Post.
This isn't the only province where these corporate rights principles create some strange bedfellows. I'm thinking of Ralph Nader, the icon of public interest law. At one point, he was a friend of pharma and delivered a precedent that would inform Citizens United.
Counterintuitively, no one has done more to expand the speech rights of business corporations than Ralph Nader. In the 1970s, Ralph Nader was representing a group of consumers challenging a law that restricted the advertising of drug prices. Now, Nader's goal was only to help consumers, but he won an important victory in the Supreme Court that established the rights of businesses to advertise their prices. Businesses would use those rights in later years to strike down laws restricting graphic labels on tobacco and other kinds of disclosure laws and advertising restrictions that were enacted in the name of consumers. The identity of the speaker was irrelevant. All that mattered was whether the speech was valuable to the listeners, like the consumers.
We hold that these consumers enjoy the same First Amendment protection that advertisers have to disseminate prescription drug price information, and thus that the appellees, as recipients of the information, have standing to bring the suit.
The Supreme Court would use that very same theory in Citizens United to say it didn't matter that it was corporations spending money on election ads, only that those ads were valuable to the public.
When the government seeks to use its full power, including the criminal law, to command where a person may get his or her information, or what distrusted source he or she may not hear, it uses censorship to control thought. This is unlawful.
We think of the courts as being governed by neutrality and objectivity. But in truth, the way the courts are structured is really beneficial to corporations. They can hire the best lawyers. They can bring the most lawsuits. They've got the resources to really exercise their influence in the Supreme Court. The fight against corporate rights can be won by we the people. And we may have come close to having a Supreme Court that would overturn Citizens United. Had Merrick Garland successfully made it to the Supreme Court, it seems almost certain that there would have been five justices to vote to overturn Citizens United. But with the new justice appointed to the Supreme Court, who seems largely inclined to favor corporations in their constitutional rights claims, it seems like changing the Supreme Court is a ways off.
There's another way of going about this, and that would be a constitutional amendment enshrining once and for all the last word on the difference between individual and corporate rights. And there are 19 states and a whole mess of municipalities that have gotten behind such an amendment, but you're not necessarily rooting for them. Why?
Well, I totally sympathize with the frustration that people have and the desire to limit corporate influence in politics. But a constitutional amendment that would declare that corporations are not people and have no rights under the Constitution would be way too broad. It would mean that business corporations like the New York Times and CNN wouldn't have any protection against censorship. It would mean that corporations don't have a right of property that's protected by the Constitution. It would mean that corporations could be charged with crimes without having a right of due process or a right to be innocent until proven guilty. I think 100 years ago, the Supreme Court drew a line. It said corporations should have property rights and protections for their assets, but not liberty rights, rights associated with personal conscience and political freedom. And today's Supreme Court seems to have lost sight of that distinction, expanding the liberty rights of corporations ever more, including political speech in Citizens United and religious liberty in Hobby Lobby.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA, is the author of We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Coming up, when the story is heartbreakingly obvious and also not true. This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them. because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. When Omar Mateen opened fire in a gay Orlando nightclub in June 2016, killing 49 people and wounding 58 others, it was at the time the deadliest shooting by a single gunman in U.S. history. Mateen died in a police shootout that ended the attack and therefore could not explain his motive. Speculation naturally followed. Was he a lone wolf jihadist, a homophobe? And did he really act alone? Was his wife, Noor Salman, a co-conspirator? Earlier this month, the question of Salman's involvement came to a definitive conclusion.
Nearly 2 years after the deadly mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Florida, the gunman's wife, Noor Salman, was found not guilty today of aiding in the attack.
Huffington Post reporter Melissa Jeltsin covered the trial, and she says that much of the initial media coverage of the shooting followed red herrings and let the narrative be dominated by gay activists and the police. She saw one theory that Mateen had committed the atrocity because he was a self-denying, self-hating gay man take hold soon after the attack.
Within days, people came forward who believed they had seen him at Pulse before. Others thought they recognized his face from Grindr, a gay dating app. One person even went on Univision wearing a mask and said they had had sex with him. So the narrative was driven by eyewitnesses who came forward, plus the natural human instinct to believe that it must have been a targeted attack against the gay community. I mean, this is a community that has historically been marginalized and been persecuted. There was an instinct to believe that he chose them because of who they loved, and he purposely set out that night to kill gay people.
This quickly mutated from speculation or theory to a kind of righteous certainty.
Investigators know Mateen was homophobic.
Omar Mateen was a regular at gay clubs, including the site of his attack, Pulse,
for homophobic, years. Even a closeted gay man.
Yeah, it just became the accepted narrative. And this is despite Omar Mateen's own statements during the crimes. He was on the phone with hostage negotiators, and he said, "I pledge allegiance to ISIS. I'm doing this to avenge airstrikes in Syria and Iraq." He didn't make any gay slurs while he was there. He didn't mention anything about the LGBT community. He was very specific about it being an attack during Ramadan to protest U.S. intervention in the Middle East.
But to paraphrase what we say in journalism, never let the facts get in the way of a good explanation. Sure enough, at the widow's trial, the actual facts cited in testimony blew that theory apart altogether.
We learned at the trial that Omar Mateen left his house that night with a rifle, with a Glock, and it looks as if he intended to target Disney Springs, which is a Disney property. But when he got there, there was a lot of security, and it looks like he was deterred, and he Googled downtown Orlando nightclubs. From there, he went to another nightclub, Eve Orlando, the straight nightclub, was also deterred and Googled downtown Orlando nightclubs again and ended up at Pulse. Now, you know, Pulse doesn't have any insignia outside that would show that it's a gay club. And a security guard said when he walked in, he asked him, "Where are all the ladies at?"
All right. Another narrative that emerged was the presumed culpability of the widow, Noor Salman.
Sources tell Fox News Mateen's wife did know about plans for this possible attack and did not alert authorities before the shooting.
Law enforcement sources say Noor Salman purchased ammunition with her husband, and they believe she drove with him as he scouted the Pulse nightclub.
Noor Salman accompanied her husband, Omar Mateen, to the Pulse nightclub where that massacre unfolded, as well as went with him to a Florida gun store where Mateen purchased weapons and ammo.
Yeah, so the FBI interviewed Noor Salman in the immediate aftermath of the massacre. They pulled her out of her house at 4 o'clock in the morning and brought her to FBI headquarters and held her there for 11 hours. By the end of the interrogation, they had a handwritten statement that an FBI agent wrote for her because she was too nervous to write herself. And there's many iterations of this quote-unquote confession, but the last one says, "I knew that my husband was going to Pulse that night. I knew because we had cased it together a week ago, and I knew because I had saw him looking at the website." that was the government's key piece of evidence against her. But their investigators knew within a few days of the massacre that her alleged confession couldn't possibly be true because they had forensic evidence. They had her cell phone, they had Omar Mateen's cell phone, and they learned quite quickly that she had never been to Pulse, he had never been to Pulse. It just wasn't true.
How did a year and a half go by without the press asking the obvious questions that would have led to the same conclusion?
I'm not really sure. Some government officials did release a statement, even just a few months after Pulse, to say, you know, we've investigated these claims that he was on Grindr or that he was a closeted gay man. They interviewed 500 people and could not corroborate a single one. And so there were a few news outlets who covered that, but not to the extent that it would upend the narrative that had already become so embedded. So it's taken this trial, and I think that the benefit of this trial is that we've learned for the very first time a lot more about Omar Mateen. He just spent all day on his phone looking at ISIS videos, reading about airstrikes. Noor Salman, on the other hand, was not radicalized at all. Prosecutors could find zero evidence that she'd ever looked at an ISIS video, liked anything on social media about terrorism or ISIS. I mean, they had nothing.
In fact, it turns out, once you get past the coerced confession, far from being a co-conspirator, Salman was really Omar Mateen's first victim.
She absolutely was. She has told her family that he was extremely physically abusive to her. He was very sexually abusive to her. And he was also incredibly controlling of all her daily activities. Omar Mateen's first wife has also come forward and described a very similar situation when she was married to him, where she was almost a prisoner in the home. I don't think it's hard to imagine that a person like Omar Mateen, who was willing to walk into a nightclub and just slaughter dozens of people, would be extremely violent inside the home.
There is this New York Post with a cover photo of Noor Salman and the headline, "She Could Have Saved Them All." How widely was she tried and convicted in the press?
The media got it wrong because they depended on the government to tell them the story. Law enforcement had all these leaks to national news that had the contents of her confession. So they told NBC, amongst others, that she knew what he was planning, that she went to Pulse with him. When I walked around Orlando and talked to people, I couldn't find anyone that thought she could be innocent. From what they were hearing from the government, she knew he wanted to kill gay people, and she didn't do anything about it. The feelings against her were very strong and very ungenerous in their interpretation that she could be innocent or that she could be a victim herself.
The Advocate, the Gay Weekly magazine, has been quite critical of your coverage. It insists that no matter what was proven at the trial, the events of June 2016 were indeed an act of violent homophobia.
Yes. So the argument is that no matter if he picked it at random, if he didn't know he was going to end up killing gay people that night, that when he made the decision to do it, it was an act of homophobia. Now, I don't claim to know what was in his heart, and we know he aligned himself with ISIS, which is obviously no friend to the gay community. So he may very well have been homophobic in terms of his personal feelings, but we have no evidence that that drove his actions that night. It was such a horrific, painful attack on the LGBT community. And learning that it was just bad luck that they became the victims that night, that can be really difficult to grapple with. Someone asked the owner of Pulse how she felt when she learned that. And she said, it doesn't make it any easier and it doesn't make it any harder. It just makes it different.
Melissa, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Melissa Jeltsin is a senior reporter at the Huffington Post. Her recent article is titled, "Everyone Got the Pulse Massacre Story Completely Wrong." If the professional media are too often suckered by the wrong narrative that seems so right, social media are channels for much, much worse. 6 years ago in Steubenville, Ohio, two high school football players were found responsible in juvenile court for the rape of a 16-year-old girl. That was the official end of the incendiary story. But for those in Steubenville who lived through it, the truth never caught up with the lies that had spread online and the vigilante terror that resulted. Now a documentary reveals the danger of crowdsourcing justice to online activists filled with righteous but blind rage and false assumptions about a cover-up that never was. Radio producers Derek John and Anders Kelto produced a three-part series called Steubenville for the Audible show Game Breaker. Derek is here now. He is a former OTM producer. Hey, man, welcome back.
Hey, Bob. Great to be back.
This horrendous tale all began with a high school party in Steubenville in 2012. What happened that night?
The local powerhouse football team, Big Red, has a preseason scrimmage game on a Friday night. And later that night, a lot of the players and other students are at a pretty, you know, raucous party. And a 16-year-old girl from a neighboring town just across the river, Weirton, West Virginia, travels with a couple of these high school football players from one party to the next. She gets increasingly drunk, at some point passes out. The boys assault her in various ways. And then, you know, she wakes up the next day kind of having no clue what had happened.
But there were clues as to what happened because the kids responsible for this sexual violence tweeted, texted, posted an ugly image on Instagram, and other friends then uploaded a YouTube video joking about what had taken place.
She is deader than Kaylee Anthony.
There's this, you know, infamous picture of her passed out being carried out of one of the house parties.
Steubenville is a sort of Friday night lights kind of town. High school football is a very big part of the community, and it did not take long for this social media stuff to be the talk of the town. Among those who saw this social media traffic were the victim's own parents, who downloaded it onto a thumb drive and gave it to local law enforcement.
Yeah, so this is where the unsung hero of our story enters the stage. Jane Hanlon was the county prosecutor there in Jefferson County.
We're going to hear you narrating here.
In sexual assault cases, in child abuse cases, in homicide cases, we're the only thing standing in between the victims and the people that did this.
Jane has never really talked in depth about her role in this case. It took months and months of calls from us to convince her to tell her story. It's understandable. She still feels burned by the national media and the internet mob who came after her and her family. You know, she sees all of this traffic on Twitter, and she has a son who is also at the local high school who knows a lot of the boys. He's also on the football team. Now, he was not at the party, which is a crucial detail. But she knows a lot of these boys. She knows her Twitter handle. She's kind of a bit of a helicopter mom.
I could take a look at the video and say, that's this young person, that's this young person, even some of them by name.
Now, the thing about criminal investigations, especially one in which the victim and the suspects are all juveniles, is that they are very much under wraps. So even though Jane Hanlon was moving very quickly on this, the outside world didn't know that at all. And they began filling in the blanks.
That's right. A former Steubenville resident, Alexandria Goddard, who's now living in California, she's an amateur crime blogger, happens to stumble upon this little news item.
And I was underwhelmed at how much the local news was saying about it.
And she instantly thinks, well, okay, these are two football players in this town where these guys are worshipped. They're going to get away with it. Unbeknownst to her, of course, Jane Hanlon and the detectives have found all this stuff and have solved it. So, you know, she's up all night. She's screen grabbing these tweets, all these things that she thinks essentially she's the only one who has found.
I was furious. I was disgusted.
So Alex decides she wants to write a blog post to show her support for the victim, Jane Doe.
And I wanted to give her a voice.
Her blog becomes a kind of central clearinghouse for every rumor, bit of gossip and innuendo you could imagine around this case.
It was a kind of zeitgeist narrative because this was right on the heels of the Penn State scandal.
Coach, as Jerry Sandusky faces charges of molesting eight boys.
Shocking allegations of sexual child abuse and a pair of university bigwigs are accused of covering it all up.
Penn State came up a lot in our reporting on this as this sort of template that was already there. The high school football coach at Steubenville is very much a kind of Joe Paterno character, this old school Italian guy named Reno Sakac, who had been there like 35 years. The field is named after him.
We are Big Red on three. 1, 2, 3.
We are Big Red.
Let's go.
It just seemed like, you know, the parallels were kind of irresistible.
This was also a moment in time where this sort of loosely connected online anarchist group, Anonymous, was taking justice in its own hands.
Get as much people as you can involved. Eventually the FBI will get involved if we try hard enough. What if this was your daughter? Would you just sit here and do nothing?
This guy, who we later find out, his name is Derek Lostutter. He's this 20-something kid from Kentucky, comes from kind of a broken family, says he's also been the victim of abuse, but, you know, really into computers, kind of that prototypical hacker profile. But he links up with Alex Goddard, the blogger. In fact, she actually reaches out to him.
We had actually been emailing and tweeting to, like, Nancy Grace and others. And so that is when Get Anonymous involved came into play, and everybody is looking.
And then Derek Lostutter really ramps up the pressure.
Let's fight for what's right. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
This Anonymous threat leads to a kind of ongoing terrorism against a whole bunch of innocent parties, of whom Jane Hanlon was but one.
Her son is on this football team. So after the first couple of weeks when she essentially solves the case, she actually officially recuses herself because she doesn't want there to be this conflict of interest. The case is referred to the state attorney general. And so she's off the case for months before Anonymous even gets involved.
Hey, Jane. My name's Scott. I'm calling from Florida. I raped a couple girls in Ohio, and I heard that you're the one to go to get me off the charges, you fucking bitch.
There's a bomb threat at one of the local elementary schools. These reports of mysterious goings-on in the night, people in these Guy Fawkes masks knocking on doors, running around. It's a very scary thing, and especially for a town like Steubenville, pretty small rural town, and it's suddenly like the world just descended on their town, and they don't really know what to believe. One of the biggest ironies of the case that we stumbled on is you have these eyewitness bystander accounts from high school kids, and they're just getting pilloried. They're getting threatened online, and it actually starts to jeopardize the case that the state attorney general had built up to that point.
Is there a sense now in the general public that the vigilantes were on the wrong track all along?
The lasting impression was that there was some sort of small-town cover-up to protect the football team. And yes, these boys may have ultimately been found guilty or, you know, at least held responsible in the juvenile system, that if it hadn't been for the internet vigilantes and the folks with Anonymous, that they probably would have gotten away with it. I think that's still the kind of vague impression 5 years later. If you Google Jane Hanlon, one of the top results even to this day is a petition to disbar her.
Now, all of this internet hysteria, which did so much damage, began with Alexandria Goddard, who herself was a victim of sexual assault, who felt she knew the Steubenville community pretty well, and was righteous in her efforts to get to the bottom of things, but she got to a false bottom. How does she feel looking back at the terror that she unleashed?
So she has a lot of regret, actually. She says that she rued the day she ever got in touch with Derek Lostutter, the guy with Anonymous. I mean, hacking is a federal crime. And in fact, Derek Lostutter eventually is charged and is currently serving 3 years in prison. He's banned from the internet for another 5 years. And I think she really thought she was doing the right thing. But there just came a point where it was really probably doing more harm than good. And I think she recognizes that now. But it's worth saying, Bob, within this maelstrom of misinformation, there was a real kind of genuinely authentic and pretty amazing coming together and empowerment of rape survivors. There was this large rally in town, a lot of people wearing the Guy Fawkes masks, but at some point in the middle of that, there's this beautiful little scene where these women start taking off their masks and they get up in front of the microphone and tell their story. And it seems like not that surprising now in this sort of Me Too moment, but I think then it was a really big deal, especially in a place like Steubenville.
My name is Haley, and at the age of 14, I was raped by a star football player that I had a crush on. I thought he was so nice.
In the most bitter irony, the prosecutor who actually solved the case, Jane Hanlon, is the one who ends up having to, you know, move out of state on the eve of the trial because of yet another death threat.
Derek, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bob. Thank you so much.
Derek John is a radio producer based in Chicago. His latest work with his colleague Anders Kelto is a three-part series on Steubenville, part of Audible's Game Breaker series. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, and Leia Feder. We had more help from John Hanrahan, Philip Yiannopoulos, and Isaac Napel. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer, Terrence Bernardo, and Greg Rippon. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.